This is the Hollywood Outsider, and this is a special episode of our show. You can always catch our normal episode, either last week's is down there now, or we have a new episode every Thursday. This week, we are going to talk to Justin McCumber, author of the new book, Stillwater, which is what? It should be in stores right now by the time you listen to this. Before we get into that, you can always go to thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can find our show on iTunes, Stitcher, through the website, and pretty much anywhere else you can find an RSS feed. With that, let's get into it. Justin McCumber, author extraordinaire. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on for this special episode all about me, though.
We're not worthy.
That's true. But I kind of figure every episode's kind of about me.
Yeah, well, you definitely kind of figure that. You sure do. And Scott Clark is joining us as well. Scotty?
Hey, how's it going, buddy?
Good. Scott has a genius idea for what we should call this episode.
Yeah, I think we should definitely call this Inside a Hoe.
I can't argue that.
No, I think it's fantastic. If it wasn't that, it might taint the message that Justin's book is selling.
Really?
Yeah, I just went there. So before we get into like just talking about it, why don't you tell us what Stillwater, the book, which is already out in stores. It's on, where is it available at, Justin?
Should be available on Amazon.com, should be Barnes & Noble. I think Smashwords should also have it. And hopefully the iBook store will have it as well.
And we do want to say, this isn't like the first book he's ever written. He also wrote Haywire. He wrote A Minor Magic, which you have a sequel to that one coming out hopefully in the near future. And those are all available. And those are also interviews on the Hollywood Outsider. You can scroll through and find those if you want to listen to those as well. But tell us what Stillwater's about.
Simply put, I mean, Stillwater is about a fictional coal mining town in West Virginia called Stillwater. It's one of those typical towns in the West Virginia, kind of Kentucky area that has grown up around coal mining, and kind of its fortunes have risen and fallen as the coal mining operations have gone. But it's a small town. The coal mining industry in that area has really kind of fallen to the wayside. And so it's one of those small, just little bitter places that you don't hear about too much. Unfortunately, within the mountains that surround this area that they're mining for coal, there also just happens to be this ancient dark god that has been slumbering in the mountain in a cavern buried under water. And has been sleeping for millions of years until one of these coal mining operations happens to breach through that cavern wall and begins to let the water out that once held this creature at bay. And now slowly but surely, this ancient evil god is awakening within its chamber while the town around it is starting to become affected by it.
And I do want to preface that. I've actually read this, but I read... Did I read a pre-finished version? So you've actually
made
changes. Yeah,
you read an early copy.
Okay. And the one that I read, I would equate it to if people that read, whatever those people are trying to understand where it falls in line, I would say it's a mix between Stephen King and Lovecraft is kind of where I would put it.
Well, that seems to be the consensus. I've gotten some really nice reviews from some authors who write horror, and most of them seem to be putting King and Lovecraft. The Lovecraft part is intentional. I mean, when I wrote it, Lovecraft's stories are a big influence for any horror author. You know, and the idea of these dark elder gods and their powers are something that I wanted to reference directly. So that's not surprising, but people pulling out King is a bit of a reference. You know, I have to take it with a smile because I'm a huge King fan, but I would never, ever, 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 ever. I'll let other people say what they want, but I would never say I'm trying to be like King or as good as King, because to me, there's nobody better than he is.
Well, in terms of that, the small town atmosphere, the people converging on a town, finding a dark secret, that sort of thing is very King-like. And then when you get into the actual story, which is, you touched on it, but you really didn't go too much in detail.
I try not to. Yeah, I don't want to spoil anything.
No, once you get into it, it's very Lovecraftian as well. I'll be honest, and I'm not saying it's just because Justin's, you know, been on our show for 3 years. You know, he's one of our hosts. It's a matter of, it's a good book. It's really, really well done. And I've read the other three books. It's easily my favorite that Justin's written. It's a book that I highly recommend. So that's one reason why I'm touting it as much as I am. So even if you weren't Justin McCumber friend, I would still be touting it.
Oh, thank you.
That's about as good a compliment as I can get.
Hey, Justin, did I remember you saying to you some of your influence with the story was from the Silent Hill series?
Mm-hmm.
The coal mining town, that kind of thing?
Well, not the coal mining part. What I love about Silent Hill, the games, is that, the stories always seem to take place across two different versions of a place. There's the smoky, kind of foggy version of Silent Hill, and then there's the very dark hellscape version. But I quite often found the foggy version the scarier one, because fog can play tricks, and there's all sorts of ways that it can scare you through, these visions that you can barely see scuttling through the fog, the sounds, the creaking of trees or bridges. And that really always resonated well with me. And when I thought of Stillwater, I didn't want to go with fog, but one of the big motifs of the book is water itself, whether it's rain or the river or the reservoir, or just this general unsettling moistness. I'm not quite sure how to put it, but what Silent Hill did with fog, I really kind of wanted to do a bit with rain and water.
Mm. Now, let me ask you a question in terms of, because you're writing a horror novel, or you've written a horror novel, I want to know you've already mentioned King and Lovecraft, but what are your influences? Like, what are your favorite all-time books, movies in that genre?
Well, writing-wise, King is definitely at the very top of my list. I mean, for me, The Stand is the best book I think I've ever read, period. It doesn't matter genre or author. The Stand is just an incredible story about a group of people in this kind of post-apocalyptic world, and the forces of light and darkness that are, kind of playing above and around them. I absolutely adore it. I've read it 3 times so far, and I'm sure I'll read it several times more, even though it is thick enough to, if you drop it off a house, it will crush any child walking.
It's a big book. I've read that one. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a thick one, but his Dark Tower series, if I could ever write anything even approaching the complexity and brilliance that at least I have for that I think of as the Dark Tower series, I would. But I'm a big, Dean Koontz fan. When I was a teenager, I started reading his books like Watchers and Twilight Eyes and The Mask and Phantoms and all sorts of Koontz books back before he kind of left horror and went more into the thriller side of writing. I much preferred his horror stuff. And
before you move on, I'm curious, why do you think his books haven't translated well to film? Dean Koontz.
I honestly don't know, because it's not as though his stories are any more or less complex or difficult than other horror stories. I wonder if it's maybe just the people who want to adapt it, maybe they're not up to the task. I really don't know, but he's a brilliant writer, and I wish Dean Koontz had gotten more love and attention back when he was writing horror. But there's an author named Robert R. McCammon that I am a massive fan of, especially when I was younger. One of his books is called Swan Song, and if there was one book I would compare to The Stand in a favorable way, it would be Swan Song, because I wouldn't say it's exactly like it, but there are enough themes and tones to it that it harkens right to it. It's about this girl named Swan, and she has survived this kind of nuclear apocalypse, and her and some travelers have to stop the devil from taking over the world. And it's just so bizarre and wonderful. McCammon has written so many books I adore. Boy's Life is a great story.
I've read a lot of his work, but I haven't read Swan Song.
They Thirst. All those books are just so good. But I've long been a horror fan of the novels and the movies, and it's really been a thrill to start kind of changing my direction of writing into that direction.
What about movies? What are your favorite horror movies?
Oh, hands down, The Exorcist is my all-time favorite. And it's not because it's based on a book, which the book itself by William Peter Blatty is a magnificent piece of horror fiction, if you want to call it that, though it is supposedly based on a true story. Anything like The Exorcist, Exorcism of Emily Rose, The Conjuring, any of those kinds of stories that deal with malevolent spirits, and, you know, these families that are struggling to survive them. Right now, I'm actually reading Clive Barker's story, The Hellbound Heart, which is what the Hellraiser stories are loosely based on, and really enjoying that. I've liked Clive Barker for a long time, but his imagination is so out there.
It's twisted.
And it is very twisted, but when you read books like Imogika, or you look at books like Weave World, where he creates these creatures and landscapes that are almost fantasy. It's like this weird intersection of fantasy and horror. And his ability to just create these unusual societies and peoples is almost without parallel. So when he got into doing movies and, you know, with Hellraiser and some of his other work, Nightbreed, those are some favorites too. But then, you know, you also get into the Evil Deads, and we've talked about those before. And really, supernatural horror itself is just a film genre that even when it's bad, I still kind of enjoy it.
Same here, man.
I am kind of with you on that too, Justin. I had a question too about the cover. I'm looking at it here actually while we're talking, and for those that haven't seen it, it's like it's got a lot of green on it. Who did the artwork?
That was my brother.
Oh, it's really awesome. I really like it.
Yeah, he did the covers for Haywire. Haywire's got two covers. And he also did the cover for a lot of my short stories. He did the one for this one. In fact, David Wood, who oversees Griffinwood, has actually got him doing a lot of his covers as well as some of his other authors' covers. So my brother's graphic ability seems to, right now, he's getting to use it quite a bit, and I'm glad for that because I think he's pretty good at it.
Yeah, it's very good. I love the use of the color. It just gives it a very creepy, ominous vibe, which is obviously what you're going for. So,
Now, what brought you, because you wrote Haywire, which is sci-fi, and then you wrote Minor Magic, which is very YA fantasy, I would say. Mm-hmm. What made you say, okay, the next book's got to be a horror book?
Well, there's a scene in A Minor Magic where Skylar and Nathan and one of the other characters, Bill, have to go into a hospital, to this abandoned hospital, to look for some supplies because they don't want to depend on anyone's magical abilities to help them if one of them gets hurt, you know. So they go in there looking for any kind of alcohol or peroxide or something that they can take with them so that they can deal with wounds on the go and not have to depend on magic. And so they go through this hospital, and, you know, the first few areas, it looks kind of dank and dark, but nothing too terrible. But the further they go into it looking for these supplies, the more they see these, you know, blood on the walls and these dead bodies and just this general feeling of there's something here that they're not seeing, but they know that they can feel it. And they reach a point to where they're looking down this elevator shaft, and all of a sudden these tentacles come rising up out of it and kind of chase them through the hallways of this hospital as they run from it. And I enjoyed writing that scene so much, trying to find imagery and the proper words that would depict how scary this moment was for them. And it was a muscle that I had never really exercised much in my, you know, my writing life, that to suddenly have a good moment to use horror was a lot more fun than I thought it would be. And I thought to myself that if this one chapter was this much fun, how much fun would a whole book be? And so that's why I did it.
When people talk about you, or when they say,
yeah,
you
know, Justin, we do.
Justin, no. I mean, in a positive way. Not
the
way
we talk about him. Sorry.
You know, what's the perception that you want people to think of as you're writing? I mean, do you want them to think of you as a horror writer or as a science fiction? I mean, are you just want to be like, have broad strokes, or what's your goal?
Well, that's the hard part about being a writer. I'm really jealous of my friends and fellow writers who have carved out a niche for themselves, whether it's science fiction or horror, or, you know, I've got some friends who write erotica, and it's what they do. And when you think of them, that's what you think of. And, you know, when you think of someone like Stephen King or Tom Clancy, you know, you think of particular genres. And I think that's interesting. And I would love to kind of do that. But I grew up watching science fiction movies and westerns and horror. And I consume those things in other mediums. And so when it comes to writing, as much as I might like one particular genre over another, I'm still drawn to all of them. And so I don't think I'm going to be one of those authors that everyone thinks of the same way of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would like it if I had people who really enjoyed my fantasy novels, but then gave the other ones a try and enjoyed those too. But I'm not going to expect that everyone who likes my science fiction work is going to like my fantasy or is going to like my horror. Mm-hmm. And so there's always that potential of kind of creating a schism between your readers. And I kind of hate to do that, especially if they're like a fan of my science fiction. And then it takes two or three books before I get back to it. That mm-hmm. can be a long wait, but I have to be, oh God, this could sound so artsy fartsy, but you know, I've got to be true to who I am as a writer. And some days I'm a science fiction writer and some days I'm a horror writer. I can't take one of those loves and put it in a box and, you know, put it up on the shelf. I have to constantly be engaged in all of them, but that doesn't mean that I can't find ways to mash these genres together. And I've got a couple of books in mind that take science fiction and horror and really mash them together. And so hopefully even if you like one and maybe not another, maybe one of those sorts of books will bring you to liking both.
I got a publishing question for you. Mm-hmm. You started the Dead Robot Society, which is a podcast devoted to aspiring writers, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so you've talked to a lot of them. But you yourself, as a writer, you know, you are published by an actual publishing company. There's a lot of people out there that are self-published or that publish themselves, so to speak. Mm-hmm. How does that interfere or affect other writers that are going that the public route, I guess, so to speak? You understand what I'm saying? Does that make sense? In terms of, does self-publishing dilute like your work?
And that's one of the questions that the publishing industry and writers are having to kind of struggle with right now. It's, you know, because there are companies out there that will, you know, do print on demand. And so you don't have to have a big publisher. And because there's ebooks out there that almost anybody can take their work and convert it into an ebook format and post it, you know, there's always that risk that signal to noise ratio is going way too heavily into or far into the noise category. You know, how can a quote unquote good author hope to get their work out there and become noticed when they're maybe surrounded by a lot of not very good authors?
Mm-hmm.
That question is going to take a while to be answered. There's always the thought that, well, if an author's not good, then their works won't be bought and then they'll eventually disappear. And that's true to a point, but how long will it take those people to disappear? And how many more, you know, Hail Hydra, how many more are going to come in to fill their place?
Hail Hydra.
When they disappear, you know, you cut off one head, two more rise in its place. So there's always going to be a certain amount of self-published authors that aren't that good. But I can also tell you that there's a lot of self-published authors that are very good, but who have just decided that they don't want to go the traditional publishing route. And to them, I say Godspeed and good luck to you. There are so many ways to becoming a published author these days that I cannot and I won't diminish someone else's ability or their dreams to become a writer. You just have to figure out what's going to work for you and hope that your talent will see you through, and someone else's lack of talent will see them gone at some point.
And when you are writing and you are trying to get something published, or you've just gotten something published, does the publisher ever tell you, here's what I would like to see from you next? Or do they request anything? How does that work for you?
Well, they can. I mean, David Wood over Griffinwood Press, the first book of mine that he published was Haywire, and he's been wanting another book in that genre for a little while, and a lot of people who've read Haywire have requested that I write another, you know, Haywire book, whether it's a prequel or a sequel. That didn't really matter. They just want another one. And so he's asked that I write another one of those, but he's never, you know, demanded that that's what I do next. And luckily for me, his press up to the point to where I was brought on was primarily thrillers with a little bit of science fiction and just a soupçon of horror in it. But he really wants to broaden all of his offerings. And so he's been wanting more YA, he's been wanting more horror, and he's been wanting more science fiction. So if, you know, he says to me, hey, I'd like another Haywire book, and I go, okay, I might at some point, but I've got this horror novel. What do you think? He's just as willing to read that as he would have been, you know, a sequel, a prequel to Haywire. So he's never pushed me to go one route or demanded that I go a particular route at all. He just wants me to write what I'm passionate about writing, and then we'll go from there.
Excellent.
Though I am right now writing a prequel to Haywire.
I've got an editing question for you. Because again, I've only dabbled in small writings and that kind of thing, but we had at my college where I graduated from, we had a visitor, Brian Selznick, who, as you guys know, had one of his books adapted to film for the movie Hugo.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of was showing us some of the editing process in this like assembly that we had. And he showed us some of his pages that were submitted to his editor. And it was just absolutely covered with red marks and you know,
it's like it murder was committed on it.
For real. It looked like something like that I would grade one of my fifth grade papers or some, my fifth grader's papers or something. Now, you know, I've read your work, whether it be, you know, reviews on the site or your books themselves, obviously, but, and I know you're a good writer. So do you see that kind of stuff come back from your editors when you submit a copy?
Oh yeah. I mean, the thing about being a writer is there is this image that being a writer is this very solitary kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while you're working on that first or second draft, it is very solitary. But once you involve your editor into the process, then it becomes much more of a community effort. Just like making a movie is, or just like making a song is. No piece of art that ever enters the world is ever, you know, if it's good, is going to be the vision of just one person. I think people who don't want suggestions or edits, or who don't seek out critiques of what they've created, they will never go as far with it as they could have if they had involved other people, because sometimes you're just too close to your work
mm-hmm.
to see what you've left out or what you've done wrong or maybe what direction you went that maybe you didn't go far enough or you went too far. And so, you know, when you get that editor involved, yeah, you're going to get some suggestions. And I know with Haywire, there were a couple of entire chapters that he wanted me to add because he felt like the book didn't go far enough in particular directions. And so the, I think it was like the third or fourth editing pass on that book was a really tough one because there were some characters that I had left dangling, early on about the middle of the book and never got back to. And even, you know, I should have known not to do that, but I, for whatever reason, just decided to let it go. And he wasn't. And so he said, hey, you left these characters dangling. They need to, you know, they need to continue on too. So let's see what we can do to fix that. And I did. And with Haywire or with Stillwater, there were some moments that he felt like the characters were getting some information maybe a little too easily or a little too quickly. And so he wanted me to come up with a couple of scenes where they would actually have to go and do some physical research. And so there was some additional work in the editing of that book for it. But, you know, has one of my pages ever looked like it was, you know, somebody was killed on top of it? I don't know if I go that far, but I've definitely gotten some pages back that had been written up so much that I just couldn't even look at it. I'm like, all right, I'll come back to that later.
Does it ever feel like it's not your work when you take somebody's suggestion like that? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I definitely hear what you're saying. Even though it's their suggestion, I'm still the one who has to write it. And there are sometimes where their suggestions are things that I had already thought of, but for whatever reason, whether it was laziness or forgetfulness, I just didn't do it. Mm-hmm. But because they reminded me about it and pushed for it, then I went ahead and did it, and it was ultimately to the betterment of the book. But, you know, I understand from being a writer, and I understand from watching supplemental materials about TV shows and movies and video game creation that nothing is ever just one part. When a Scorsese movie comes out, it has his name on it, but the number of people involved in making it that is incredible. Mm-hmm. He could not have made any of his movies just on his own. You have to have other people's input into it. And because of that, even if one name is attached to it, there is the work of many other people involved behind it. And so when I get a book published and there are sections of it that are in it that never would have been there had it not been for someone else, I don't feel like I'm pushing someone else's work off as my own, because ultimately every word that's in there I wrote. Whether it was something I originally thought of or something suggested, I still wrote it, and it's ultimately still my words. And so because of that, I feel, you know, it is my work. But I will always try and thank, in either the acknowledgments or the dedication, you know, the person who helped me edit it together, because without them, the book wouldn't be what it is at that point of publication. And I think the books are always better because of someone else's input.
Now, are you ready for some listeners' questions?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we've got several that listeners sent in because they wanted to ask Justin themselves whatever their questions were. So we'll start with Marcus Shelton. He says, will there be an Audible version with Justin's silky tones reading the book?
There will be an audio version, but these chocolatey notes will not be the ones reading it to you. I am not a good book narrator. I find my voice gets very droney, and I wouldn't want to listen to me doing all the reading. Starting with Haywire, when we did the audiobook for that, I had a friend of mine named Veronica Jaguer, who I had known for a couple of years because of the Dead Robot Society podcast. And I'd met her at several cons, and I knew that she did narration and she was really good at it. And when I mentioned that I was going to be doing an audio version of Haywire, she really pushed to do it because she felt like women's voices weren't heard enough in audiobooks for science fiction. That's pretty much a guy's club. And she wanted to really try and break into that and bring a female voice to it. And I was more than happy to give her that opportunity, because there are a lot of female characters in Haywire, and I knew she would do a great job of it. So I asked her if she wanted to do it, and she said she wanted to. And so ultimately the audiobook that's out there right now with her voice, I think it's a better audiobook by I don't know how many degrees, because she did it versus me. She's got talent for doing voices that I just do not have and will never have. And when I did the audiobook for A Minor Magic, I went right back to her. I'm like, this is a female centered book. I think you would do a really good job with it. What do you think? And she agreed, and we did that. And she will be doing the audiobook for Stillwater, but because she's now so busy and got so many audiobook clients, she has, I've got to be put in the queue.
Ooh, I like that.
So it'll be about June or July when that comes out. But I promise you, listening to her is so much better than listening to me read a book.
We've also got one from Douglas Clayton. He says, walk us through how you started writing. Also, what or who are your influences?
Well, I think the reason I started writing is when I was a kid, I was an army brat. And early on, I think I was about 10 or 11, a friend of mine introduced me to Dungeons & Dragons. And I really loved it. I loved playing with these characters in these, in this, you know, strange fantasy world. But we didn't have enough money for me to just go to a game store and start buying all these modules, which are pre-made and pre-packaged adventures. Couldn't afford it. And so I decided that I would try to make adventures for my friends to take their characters through. And so I spent a lot of time with making these maps and making up these characters and, okay, here's where they're going and here's these places. And that's what first started my imagination working. And since then, it's kind of wavered between fantasy and then science fiction and then a little horror. And now I'm kind of waiting amidst all of them. But if it hadn't been for Dungeons and Dragons and my friends, I don't know how, if my creative or my desire to create would have ever really been sparked. But D&D did it, and that's where I got started. And luckily, I've had enough friends, family, and teachers who thought my writing was worth pursuing that I kept doing it. And I think we kind of handled the other aspect to that question
earlier.
I love King. I love Kuntz. I love Robert Heinlein when it comes to science fiction. You know, he wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, Time Enough for Love. I think Robert Heinlein is an amazing author. I like Kevin Anderson a bit. He writes some Dune and Star Wars. Timothy Zahn, who wrote the follow-up trilogy for Star Wars when it was first published, oh gosh, 92 or 93. Love those just so much. But there's way too many authors for me to go into. But if you're a horror fan, one author that I talk about a lot, and I rarely ever hear anyone else talk about him, is a British author named Brian Lumley. He's a big Lovecraft fan, but he's also written a series of vampire novels called The Necroscope. And it is the complete antithesis of Twilight. I mean, these are vampires that are just murderous, monstrous beasts. And it mixes them with this psychic division of British intelligence and how these psychics and locators and telekinetics have to battle these vampires that are coming to Earth, and then you find out where they came from. It is an amazingly inventive series of vampire novels, and I cannot recommend them enough.
Have you read Del Toro's The Strain?
I've read all three of them, and I am so looking forward to the series coming out on FX. I really, really enjoy The Strain.
He's a really good horror writer, too.
Well, it's mostly, I think, Patrick Hogan who did the writing. I think a lot of the ideas for the book came from Del Toro. But I would have to imagine from reading them, the singularity of the voice, it sounded probably that it was written by one person with a lot of Del Toro oversight and story input. It's fantastic.
We got another one from Jean Morton. She says, from start to finish, how long did it take you to write the book? And does your wife read your books?
That's a hard question because the number of hours or days you put into writing a book can quite often be interrupted by illness, vacation, writing something else for a little while. It's really hard to put a definitive time frame on how long it takes to do something. But if I were to hazard a guess, the first draft of a novel is normally about a month and a half, maybe 2 months, depending on how many other things are coming in to interrupt that flow. I try to write at least 2,000 words a day. If I can write more than that, then I will. But I try to make that my minimum is 2,000. And I know one female writer who writes upwards of 10,000 words a day. And if I could do that, I would be so far ahead of the game, but I just can't.
How many words are average for a book?
Most of my books average about 85,000 to 90,000 words. Your average novel is anywhere really between, say, 70,000 or 80,000 and 100,000.
Okay.
Now, of course, you get into the George R.R. Martins of the world and some Kings, and then you're talking upwards of 200,000 words for a book. But most of them, you know, 100,000, give or take 10,000, is your average book. And so that's where I try and slide in at. But the strange thing about that is because we are now in a post paper world, kind of, sort of, word count doesn't mean anything anymore. And page count, back in the day, if you want a little history lesson, back in the day when you had to print a book and that was the only way someone was going to buy it and read it, you had to worry about how many pages were in that book, because every single page costs a certain amount of money. And so if a publisher wants to sell a book for, say, $10, then the cost of that book to make it, print it, put the binding on it, put the cover on it, and ship it cannot cost more than a certain amount. So if an author brings you a book that's 200,000 words, well, shit, that is a lot of pages that have to go into that book. So you either charge $20 for it and risk people not buying that doorstop, or maybe you try and edit it down to something more reasonable, or maybe you split it off. You know, originally, Lord of the Rings was one book. It wasn't a trilogy. It was just the Lord of the Rings. But the publisher wasn't going to publish that huge fucking tome. And so they split it off into a trilogy, which made it easier to sell and made it easier to make money on. But now, since we're so many people are moving towards electronic books, whether the file has 100,000 words or 500,000, it's not that much different. And so how many words a book takes, and suddenly it doesn't matter as much. And so suddenly a book that's 40,000 words, maybe it wasn't worth it to print that book, because what you could charge for that wouldn't net you enough. Mm. Suddenly you can, because it doesn't cost a damn thing to produce that book in print, because you're not doing it in print, you're doing an ebook. And so it's exciting in that now books of different lengths are now getting out there in a way that they hadn't been before. So you might start finding more of the books that you pick up, and instead of it being a full 100,000, maybe they're 60,000, maybe it's 40,000. For me, as long as the story is what the author wanted it to be, I really don't care how long it is. I just want the story itself to be this complete whole thing and not just some chopped up manuscript that had to fit a certain length.
Does your wife read them?
She used to a little bit.
Now she's like, fuck that.
Well, she's not a science fiction fan. And so I really kind of hated having her read Haywire when she did. And unfortunately, that was also back when I would have her read like every other edit of it. And so she had to go through a lot reading those. She liked A Minor Magic quite a bit. But I stopped putting her through reading my stuff, especially before it was published, because, you know, I'm constantly like watching, is she enjoying it? Is she not?
Mm-hmm.
She's not laughing.
What does that eyebrow mean? Why did it go
right
up?
I mean, exactly. And so I became so overly critical that I kind of drove her crazy.
Did you ever start, like, if she just gave you a critique and you just walk around going, I could kill you in your sleep, that kind of stuff?
Well, when I first had her read my final draft of A Broken Magic, which is the sequel for A Minor Magic, she didn't like it.
Ooh, that's gonna hurt.
And that bothered me. It really did. It almost, I mean, I'll be honest, it almost caused a little bit of a problem, because, you know, I'm a writer. I take my writing very seriously. And because she enjoyed A Minor Magic so much, for her to not like A Broken Magic really kind of, you know, broke my heart a little bit. But you have to make yourself okay with that. No one is ever going to be universally loved. As much as I'm a fan of Stephen King, I know people who don't like him at all. or who like some of his books, but then they don't like other ones, and those other ones they don't like, I love.
Yeah, there's a few of them I genuinely don't like. It doesn't mean I don't like King. I just don't like those particular books.
Exactly. And so I have to be okay with people not liking my work. And for the most part, I am okay with that. But when it comes to your spouse, it does become a lot more personal. And so it took me a little while to kind of be okay with the fact that for her, that book wasn't working as well. But when I shared it with some other people, and then got back their thoughts, and they loved it. It kind of helps you realize that not every book is for every person and be okay with it. And so that's what I did. And so if she wants to read my work, great. If she doesn't want to read it, I'm not going to take offense at it. She wants to read what she wants to read, and that's how it's going to be.
Now, our last of our listeners' questions, Craig Schermerhorn, he actually has about 45 questions wrapped up into a paragraph or two. So I'm going to try and capsize this a little bit. His final question is going to be our final question. So you can, you've already been prepped for that one, just so you'd have time to be ready for it. When you're writing and you hit a wall or get writer's block, what is your last ditch effort to move past it? And also, what have you tried before, the go-to move in the past that worked or didn't work? What was your most desperate, most creative, most embarrassing, that sort of thing?
Writer's block, I have personally found that writer's block is a bit of a myth. Almost invariably, when I've encountered a moment where I am just completely stumped as to what to do, it's because I either didn't outline well enough ahead of time, or because I didn't listen to the story that wanted to be told, and rather I tried to shoehorn it into something else. There have been a lot of moments where I realized that the story's not working. And what I always have to do is I have to start working backward and go, okay, at what point did the train start jumping the tracks? Where was it that I messed up, that I didn't see something? And almost without exception, by going backward chapter by chapter by chapter, I figure out, okay, at this point here, what I should have done was head this direction, because that's where the story was kind of pushing me to go. But instead, I had what I thought would be a better idea, and so I kept steering it a different direction, and I shouldn't have done that. By doing that, by going a different direction than what the story was kind of naturally going, it stopped being what I wanted it to be, and it locked itself up. And so I go back, I figure out what I did wrong, and then I fix it, and then I move forward. And sometimes that may necessitate deleting entire chapters.
Oh, that's gotta hurt, man.
It does hurt. But, there is a saying in writing called kill your darlings. And what that means is that you have to be ruthless when it comes to editing and critiquing your story. You have got to be that person that will go in there and just chop shit off. Whether it's a paragraph or a sentence or entire chapters, you have to be willing to get in there and cut it and get rid of it. Because if the story isn't flowing right, that's your fault. And you have to get in there and make it work right. And that can be painful. But ultimately, when you get to the end of the book, after doing all that, you realize that the book is now something hopefully special and unique. And it's your voice. It's your story. And ultimately, it was worth all of the those moments of cutting out things that you didn't want to cut. Oh, this is such a great scene. I had the scene in my head from the very beginning. I don't want to do it, but I have to. There was a lot of that shit with Stillwater. There were a lot of scenes that as I was kind of thinking through the book, oh, this would be great. And this would be great. And they're not in there. And they're not in there because the story didn't want to go that direction. Again, not to get all artsy fartsy. And I kind of hate it when people talk about their characters as though they're these other beings that kind of speak to them through some portal in their brain. These characters are in my head. They, They are a part of me. I am in control of them. But if you let them run in your head and you kind of watch it as a movie, you'll be surprised what they do. And you'll be surprised the directions they go that weren't in directions you thought they were going to go. Because you're creating almost these fully formed people in your brain. And you know, your best friends, when they do something you didn't expect, well, that's kind of the same thing for these characters. And so you have to let them run and can kind of be free.
Well, we get one more question, and this one also comes from Craig Schirmerhorn, and we'll kind of wrap up with this one. He asks, if your book was made into a movie, who would you cast and want directing it, and why?
That's a great question.
Dum, dum, dum.
I would probably have James Wan direct it.
Oh, and that's The Conjuring and Saw. That's James Wan.
Yeah, he did The Conjuring. He did Saw. He's done, in fact, he's working on Fast and Furious right now. But because of The Conjuring and Insidious and Saw, I think he's got a really good eye for little bits of eeriness. And I think he does a really good job of creating scenes and locations that can get under your skin. And that's what I really want with Stillwater. It takes place in a small town, and it doesn't have, you know, just a shit ton of characters. It's very much, you know, Haywire spanned the solar system. Okay. And it had dozens of characters, major and minor. So it was a space opera. It was a big book. A Minor Magic was a little less so. It covered, you know, it covered a certain stretch of America, and it had, you know, probably about a dozen or so characters. Stillwater is much smaller than that. It's one town, really one little location, and there are two main characters with an antagonist figure. So you're really talking a very small, very narrow kind of story that's being told here. And I think James Wan, who has done these sorts of things before, would be a natural choice for it. The Conjuring, the more I think about it, the better it gets. And I would personally love to see what he would do with, you know, these characters and in the locations that I've created, whether it's in these mines or, you know, in these dank little diners or libraries. I think James Wan's the guy that I would like to see directed. I think he's got a good sensibility.
So who would you put in the movie? You got him directing it. Who's your cast?
There's two main characters in the book. The male character is Kyle, and he's he's from the town of Stillwater, and he kind of grew up his entire life with this dark cloud over him, knowing that after he graduated, he would have to go work in the coal mines, because that's really the only opportunity for a young person in this area. And he saw what it had done to his father, you know, by kind of stooping him over and making him into an angrier, bitter version of who he used to be. And he didn't want that to happen to himself. And so when he graduated from high school, he almost immediately just took off and joined the army, and spent pretty much his entire time since then in the army, whether it was overseas or back here at home. He's not an infantry guy. He works in the supply division, so he's in the rear with the beer all the time. So while he knows how to shoot a gun, and, you know, of course he has been trained, he's not frontline fighter. And he's a young guy. He's probably, I think he's about 24, 25. And, I really like Nicholas Holt.
Nicholas Holt.
I liked him in Warm Bodies. I really liked him the Beast in X-Men. I think Jack the Giant Slayer was kind of a crap movie, but it wasn't his fault. But really, it's Warm Bodies that I think really sold me on him as an actor. And he's just really, really, he brings a lot of kind of vulnerability, a little bit of innocence to him. And he also, he's a good looking kid. And I think that he would make an interesting Kyle for a movie version. But the other main protagonist in the story is a girl named Maya, who is, her father was white and her mother was black. One of our listeners, Ashley, is of, I think, of a similar heritage, and she calls it Hafrican, which
African.
Hafrican, which I think is fucking hysterical. And I don't know if I would ever be comfortable, you know, really using that as a descriptor for someone. But if Ashley used it, and then I'll use it this once. She's of mixed race, and she comes from Tennessee, and she's a blogger for a supernatural website that I actually did buy the URL for, and I may at some point actually do something interesting with it. But she has a slight psychic ability to where she can detect, you know, energies. She can see people's auras a bit, and she has the she could see spirits. And using those abilities, she's been able to create this website and blog with it, do some paranormal investigation, you know, always in the hope that eventually it may lead to a book deal or a TV deal or something. And using a computer program that a friend of hers wrote, she was able to find still water, you know, that from the outside looking in, if you just looked at Stillwater just as a town, it would look no different than so many others in that place. But if you start to take in what are the suicide rates, what are mental illness rates, murder rates, crime rates, if you start looking at statistics and you start putting statistics together, Stillwater is a very interesting place because it has a long history of having more suicides than towns of a similar size and location. It's got more mental health problems. It's got all sorts of issues that if you look at it through that lens, then all of a sudden this small little town burns as bright as a star because it has all these indicators that there is something very strange and unusual about it that other towns don't have. And so she goes to Stillwater to try and figure out, what is going on here? Is there a metaphysical explanation for people going crazy and suicides and murders? And so that's why she ends up in Stillwater. And through circumstances, her and Kyle come together and start investigating. Even though he's from that town, there are a lot of things about it that he thinks he knows, but he doesn't know. And so together, they figure out what's going on in Stillwater, what's happened, and ultimately, you know, can they stop what's happening, or is it something that's too big for them? And you know, it's hard to find an actress that would fit that kind of role. I don't have a database of mixed race actresses, but there is one. There's a girl named Tessa Thompson who, if you were a fan of Veronica Mars, she was on that show, I think, for a season or two. She was kind of a love interest for, what was that guy's name?
Wallace?
For Wallace.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I remember now.
She's a very pretty girl. She's in the right age range. And her general look is exactly what I imagined Maya to have. The only thing she would have to do would be to put in contacts because Maya's got blue eyes.
Because you just had to be different, didn't you?
Well, it's an indicator of her mixed heritage.
Like Stacey Dash?
Yes, very much like Stacey Dash. Or when you look at Vanessa Williams, you know, she's got blue eyes, and those are real, and those are hers. And it's just, it's an indicator of who she is. And, of course, her adventure in Stillwater is different than Kyle's because it is a kind of a backwoods sort of a place. And because of the evil that's been permeating this town, their reaction to her is not very pleasant for her and for some others. I won't go into it, but she's definitely got some race issues going on in this town, and I think all that plays to it.
I like it, man. Any closing thoughts, or Scott, do you have any closing thoughts before we go run out and buy our book?
I actually just pre-ordered it while we were recording this, so my copy will be here in a couple of days.
You should be able to buy it at Amazon, as well as Barnes & Noble's, maybe Smashwords, maybe the iBookstore. I'll have to find those out. But it's, you know, it's the first horror book I've written, but it's not going to be the last one. I've got quite a few of them in mind. I really enjoyed writing it. Writing horror or books that take place in a modern kind of setting, in some ways, it's so much easier than writing a science fiction or fantasy where you're constantly having to invent locations and places. And, you know, with Haywire, it's constantly, is there an atmosphere? Is there not? How are they dealing with it? What does this place look like? What's a blah, blah, blah. It can get really difficult to create an environment that people can visualize and get into. But with a book like Stillwater, it takes place in our world. I don't have to do a lot of heavy lifting regarding, you know, what is a car? What's a house?
Right.
You know, these are all things we know. And so it's kind of nice to not have to do all that prep work and that kind of understanding for what is, what are these locations. Most of my research was into stuff that was a little bit scarier to research. I mean, how do you go to Google and type in, how do I make a bomb? And not get a little, you know, the NSA, I'm sure, has got a light.
Oh, they're probably at your house right now, but they're there for other reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I had to do Google searches on bombs, on detonators, on guns and shotguns and all sorts of things that I'm sure have put me on a person of interest list. But, you know, I had to do it because the book has all that in it. So, you know, I don't use explosives on my own, so I got to go and research it. But I'm really proud of it. I loved writing Stillwater, and I'm so glad that it's now going to be coming out. I'm proud of the work my brother put into the cover and that David Wood and Griffin Wood Press have put into editing it and making it as good as it can be. And I hope that people who read it enjoy it. It is not some kind of subtextual screed against coal mining industry. It's not any kind of ding against West Virginians. I mean, my wife's family's from Virginia. I love the West Virginia area. It's so beautiful. It's an evil town, but not because it's filled by people who are bad. There is luckily a dark god that we can all blame for the badness that some of these people are doing. But I'm really proud. I hope people like it, and I hope they reach out and let me know, good or bad, what they thought of it.
And I want to thank you again for having the characters Aaron, Scott, and Brian in the book. That's fantastic.
Haven't had those yet. If I need victims, though, you know, just some kind
red
of
shirts.
Yeah, just somebody who pops up for a moment and then gets their head ripped off.
Don't worry.
I do have some names.
It isn't like I wasn't reading the whole book going, no, I'm still not in it. So it's like three books, and I still haven't made it. What do I got to do to get in one of your books other than have a better name?
Hey, my brother's not had a character for him.
You would kill two birds right there. Yeah,
I know. You get both of us.
See,
my wife has got a character named after her, but only because she paid for it in a short story. I don't normally put people I know into books, whether it's just their name or, you know, their entire being. It's not something I'm really kind of comfortable doing because I may have to kill you, and I don't want people going, does this mean he doesn't like me?
If you have a dark, scary god, I think I'd fit. That's all I'm saying.
You think so?
So you don't know anybody named Kyle? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know any, not that I'm aware of or basing a Kyle off of.
There's somebody listening to this right now going, damn it, my name's Kyle.
I thought I was the guy, man. All right, well, thanks, Justin. And the book is Stillwater. It is available now when you're listening to this, so run off and buy it. We will have links in the show notes and on the website, thehollywoodoutsider.com. Again, we have new episodes every Thursday. So our previous episode is already out, as well as all the other ones. And our new one will be out on Thursday. So whenever you're listening to this, pretend the next Thursday, that'll be the one. And again, it's called Stillwater. It is out now. Please buy it and support Mr. McCumber. He's very proud of this one. I've read it. It's a great book, and I highly recommend it. So please get it and enjoy it, whether you want to support him or just support authors or just because you want a good horror book.
No, you need to support me.
Okay, or just to support
my wife's been hinting that I might have to get a job, and I don't want to get a job.
There you go. See?
I like writing, and so
support his illustrious lifestyle.
That's right.
All right, guys. Thanks, and next time you go to a bookstore, buy Stillwater.
There you go.
Take care, guys.